following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho, the pot of Fandahua and rock and roll. The People's Podcast has arrived. The remedy for boredom is here. Let's go for a ride. Woo! Brand new cowbell action for you, the people that love Talk Is Jericho. Thank you so much for being here. Jerichoholics, how in the H-E double hockey sticks are you, eh? I'm having a great day. I'm here in a downtown New York City hotel. Ain't nothing like New York City when it comes to the hustle and bustle. Hot time, summer in the city. Back of my neck feeling dirty and pretty. Or dirty and gritty. Dirty and pretty. You can be dirty and pretty. Yeah, boy. Here for a press, had a lot of press over the last couple days. Got a big Fozzy show at the Gramercy Theater tonight, which will have already happened by the time you hear this. But we are in the middle of the Lights Go Out tour, and it is rocking. I'm going to play Lights Go Out for you later on in the show, just for you to listen to. It's been a huge hit so far. Just starting to get rolling on Octane and all your local rock radio stations. If you like it, call them up. Tell them we want to hear Fozzy Lights Go Out. Got a lot of big things coming up on May 15th. We are in Arlington Heights at the Home Bar. That's in the Chicago area. On May 16th, we are headed over to Freakster's Roadhouse. Yeah, Freakster. He's a good guy. In Pontiac, Illinois. We're playing that show with Mindset Evolution. On May 15th, we're playing the Arlington Heights show with Heaven's Basement. Pretty good rock and roll band coming out of the UK. May 17th, the illustrious, huge Rock on the Range, which we're really excited about. We're doing that with Avenged Sevenfold and Volbeat and Rob Zombie and so many other killer bands. May 20th in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma at the Chameleon Room. May 21st, Little Rock, Arkansas at Juanita's. So if you're in the area, come and rock with Fozzy. It's got a great show. We've been getting great reviews. And the shows have been really hot, too. Just been kind of drenched in the sweaty, wetty when we're done. Over in the UK, heading over there in the second week of June. Of course, June 12th and June 15th, it is London Is Jericho, my spoken word Q&A show, which is looking to be a huge hit. I know that we're selling tickets at a huge rate. They're going fast. Still some left. I think most of the VIPs have been sold out at this point in time, but you can go check that out. They're going to be at Leicester Square, which is cool. It's a cool venue. I'm really excited to be coming down to rock with everybody. I did a couple of these spoken word shows a few years ago in London and in Australia. It's been a while, and I got a whole new show, a whole bunch of cool stories to tell. And a lot of it's going to be on you, a little Q&A. I'll do some tap dancing. I'll do some pie plate spinning. All of that rock and roll stuff that I can do just for you. If you want information about the shows, go to psievents.eventbrite.co.uk. That's a whole lot of those. psievents.eventbrite.co.uk. If you're looking for ticket information on London Is Jericho, and I highly suggest that you get your arson gear and come check it out. And of course, on June 14th, Download main stage with Linkin Park, Killswitch Engaged, Fall Out Boy, Dying Fetus, one of my favorite rock and roll names ever. All of us gathering along with Avenged Sevenfold, who are playing on Friday. Aerosmith will be playing on Sunday. It's going to be one of the biggest rock shows of the year anywhere in the world. So if you're going to be at Download, come check out Fozzy. And if you're not going to be there, then go. And I believe also to June 16th, I'm going to be at the Golden Gods Awards in London, the Metal Hammer Golden Gods, which I hosted a couple years ago. this year hosted by my bros in Steel Panther, and I will be there as a presenter. So that's what's going on over the next few months. Also, if you want to check me out on Tweet Secret, which is my special VIP Jerichoholics extravaganza, every month, every day, I'll be sending you videos filmed by me directly to your phone, and you can see me do a whole litany of things, and I'm doing that exclusively on Tweet Secret. So go to your app store and download the Tweet Secret app, and you will find out all the information about how you can become a part of the Jericho VIP extravaganza. Speaking of extravaganzas, we've got the Rock and Roll Regatta right here, the Entertainment Extravaganza. I heard the other day on XM Radio, Faster Pussycat, You're So Vain, which is a cover of a Carly Simon song. And it was probably one of the worst songs I've ever heard. Let's check out a little clip right now. So you can hear the way that Tie Me Down sings that. It's like, I saw you walking onto a yacht, me man. And meanwhile, Carly Simon's voice is so smooth, and it's such a beautiful song and such a provocative song. And I just thought that Faster Pussycat just butchered it. We used to call him, Pussy Dumpy Cat. That's what we called him in high school, Pussy Dumpy Cat. Never was a fan of Faster Pussycat. Didn't get it, didn't like it. All due respect to those of you who do like Faster Pussycat or did like Faster Pussycat. But it's not my bag, baby. Never really liked it. So it got me to thinking, let's go through some of the worst cover songs of all times. The first one, Limp Bizkit, they did Faith by George Michael, which worked, but then they did The Who's Behind Blue Eyes.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man behind blue eyes.
Never a good idea when you are a new metal rock rap band to try and incorporate The Who. And I found sometimes Limp Bizkit at their best were crushing, and at their worst were kind of just clueless. And I found this to be a perfect example of that, of Fred Durst not really understanding that you should probably not do that. Mariah Carey doing Def Leppard's Bringing on the Heartache.
Oh, can't you see you're bringing on the heartache.
Not a fan of that. Not really too sure. I think she probably thought it's a nice ballad, so she could get away with, you know, getting an easy hit. Did not work out. Another one was Pink doing Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Galileo, Galileo.
Now, why would you ever want to cover Bohemian Rhapsody? Like, I like Pink. I went to her concert. I had a good time. I thought she rocked. She had a great stage show. Did all that ribbon-hanging stuff. But to try and do Freddie Mercury's Tour de Force, where there's like 18 tracks of vocals, and I mean, it's such a personal song. It's a song only Freddie Mercury can get away with, as far as all the pomp and circumstance goes, and all the ballyhoo that's involved, all the ridiculosity. So I would have to say that I'm giving that a big Pink Bohemian Rhapsody gets a Bohemian Raspberry from Jericho, meaning Sheryl Crow, Sweet Child of Mine. I mean, she tried. I mean, that song does kind of have a vaguely country vibe to it. But once again, not really a song that the world is waiting for a cover of. I mean, the world is waiting for a Guns N' Roses, you know, proper reunion. Whether it were ever happen or not, we don't know. We did see Duff McKagan playing with Axl Rose over the last couple months doing Guns N' Roses gigs. So maybe that's kind of the precursor to you know, Duff played with Axl and Guns N' Roses. Now, Duff has played with Slash and Velvet Revolver, so he's the one guy that's been with both camps, so maybe he can smooth things over and try and get a little action going on there. Time to make some donuts, Duff. You have your mission. Should you choose to accept it. Avril Lavigne doing John Lennon's Imagine. Once again, such a total personal song from John. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Avril, sorry, babe. No interest in hearing it and no reason that you should have done it. You should have went and done, you know, whatever gets you through the night or something like that. Mind games, instant karma, give peace a chance. Any one of those songs is kind of wide open for interpretation. But Imagine, definitely a John Lennon personal song and not something I want to hear Avril Lavigne. Miley Cyrus, Smells Like Teen Spirit from Nirvana. Less said about that, the better. I mean, that's right up there with Friday by Rebecca Black, the official theme song for Talk is Jericho on Fridays. Faith Hill covering Janis Joplin's Piece of My Heart. She's a cool country chick. She's got a good country voice, but Janis's voice sounds like her, you know, her heart has been ripped out of her throat in that song. Like, she's just had the worst breakup ever. Like, her best friend, you know, banged her boyfriend right in front of her and you know, laughed while they did it. I mean, you can just hear the pain and the emotion in Janis's voice. In Faith Hill's collection. Another horrible one, R.E.M., Toys in the Attic. Talk about two different polar opposites. R.E.M. with their kind of jangly, wangly, jumbly, wumbly, hippy dippy music. Trying to play one of the best hard rock riffs of all time. You know, I think sometimes bands get a little bit too big for their britches. You know, where R.E.M. is like, you know, we are such a great rock band. We're going to do some Aerosmith now. Meanwhile, that's not what they do. Very ill-advised. Bad mix. It's like chocolate ice cream and vinegar. That's what I'm saying that the R.E.M. Aerosmith cover is like. Chocolate covered in vinegar, eh? Doesn't match. Fall Out Boy featuring John Mayer. Doing Beat It. Once again, you try and cover Michael Jackson, not easy. I know, I did a cover of Michael Jackson's Dirty Diana. You can hear it online now on the iTunes. There's a Michael Jackson tribute called Thriller, like metal Michael Jackson tribute. I did Dirty Diana. It wasn't bad, but I had to down-tune like a mofo. Michael's voice is so high and so powerful. Fall Out Boy did not do that. And you heard the results there. Ministry doing Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. Never once did I ever ask for an industrial metal band to do a cover of jazz, one of jazz's greatest songs and one of jazz's greatest singers. And also may I add that Pat Patterson from the WWE, Vince's right-hand man, the true genius and wizard and Jedi, and the guy who taught me more than anything I know about wrestling, sings an amazing cover of What a Wonderful World. He's a great karaoke singer, and that's his tour de force. And then the winner of the worst cover of all time, Korn with a K, doing Cameos with a C, Word Up. Say, Yeah. Not a good mix. Terrible mix. So that is my list of the worst covers of all time. Do you have other covers that you do not like? Hopefully none of them are Fozzy's. If you do have some other bad covers, let us know. Hit us up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho and fill us in. We got WWE World Champion Daniel Bryan coming up, but before we get started,
Talk is Jericho.
All right, on the line right now, the WWE World Champion. It's been a long time coming, but he did it. Daniel Bryan, congratulations, man.
Oh, thank you. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing good. I appreciate you coming on the show. I know when you become the world champion that suddenly you're in a completely different world. Everyone wants to talk to you. You got to do all the top hip shows. Everybody wants a piece of you, and I appreciate you coming to do this with me today.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It actually, I haven't actually been that busy because right after or at least people bothering me, because right after that, then Brie and I got married, and then we went on a honeymoon, and we were completely, like, off-grid, so nobody could bother us whatsoever, so that was really nice.
Well, that's one thing I love about well, both of you guys, but especially you, is you've always done things your own way, and as you know, in the wrestling business, sometimes, you know, it takes a while to establish that when you're doing things your own way, it takes a while for the people to kind of catch up with you. And I mean the office, I mean the powers that be. And you've never really cared about kind of following or fitting into whatever trend that there is in the wrestling business. You've just done it your own way, and I've always admired that about you.
Yeah, it's strange because and I really chalk that up to my lack of ambition. you know, the WWE did they did personality tests, like these things for these guys, for guys who they considered were successful or who had been who'd had good runs here in WWE, and it was like a personality assessment. And, you know, they ask you all these different questions, weird questions. Would you ever want to be a race car driver? And, like, you know, that kind of stuff. But apparently it gives you some sort of idea about somebody's personality. Well, the lady who did the testing, when I went in the next day to see the results, she said I had the lowest ambition score that she had ever seen. Like, it's on a percentile basis. Like, so it's like you're in the, you know, from 0 to 100. And I was in the bottom 1 percentile of people with ambition. She's like, how did you even get to where you are? And I said, I don't know, but it's pretty much just because I love doing this. And, like, it's not like I wasn't doing it for money, you know, at first. You know, now right. It's nice that you can make money doing it, you know, obviously. But, but yeah, it's really strange.
Is this they actually gave you this personality test, like, recently?
Oh, yeah. This was literally, like, maybe 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago. We took this. And also, another interesting thing is that one of the things that they had is, like, power. You know, your desire for power. Uh-huh. And mine was in the 0 percentile. it was really funny because me and Cesaro were just, you know, comparing and contrasting, like, our different little things. And because he's from Switzerland, but he has, I consider him to be, like, very German in personality. You know?
Yes.
And so, like, his stuff on all that stuff was way higher than mine. It's just interesting because we get along so well, you know?
That's one thing I love about the WWE is that, you know, they're very corporate, obviously. So they come up with these things that you probably take, you know, to IBM or to Apple, like these, like you said, like personality tests and then the request for power. Remember when they had the social media expert come in and talk to us? And I remember at the time I had, like, a million Twitter followers, and this company had, like, you know 110,000. They're telling me how to do Twitter, and I'm like, I think I figured out how to do Twitter. I think I got it.
Right. You know? Right. And even if you haven't figured out, like, how to the absolute correct way to do Twitter or to maximize the, you know, your most, you know, thing,
yeah,
it doesn't matter because it's working.
Yes.
You know? It's like, it might not be the textbook way to do anything, but, like, and all that, like, look at Zack Ryder. Like, he didn't
right.
have anybody telling him what to do, and he was able to create his own hit YouTube show, you know, like,
well, and,
you know, all that stuff is funny.
Yeah, he made it, you know, to the level that he made it basically on his own. But you're, I mean, you know, you're in that category, and to a certain extent, I'm in that category. I mean, there's a lot of us that came through that at first weren't deemed with the magic wand, like, okay, boom, future champion. And some guys get that. I mean, you look at Batista, Orton, or those type of guys. They, you know, the WWE knew when they walked through the door, these guys are going to be, you know, we're going to give them every opportunity to get there. Guys like you or me or Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels or Eddie or kind of the smaller guys were never really, you know, given that chance right from the start. And you had to do it on your own, but you did it just by being yourself. Like you said, working hard and doing it, you know, having a different style from everything else. When did you finally start noticing a little bit of a shift from the WWE, I guess, officials to knowing that they were behind you finally?
You know what? It's interesting because it wasn't necessarily that I felt it was essentially after, to lead to the WrestleMania moment,
mm-hmm.
it was essentially after Punk quit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it was like, well, we've got John, and then we've got, you know, and it's more, and it was really, when I first won the World Heavyweight Championship in December of 2011,
mm-hmm.
I was the Money in the Bank, I had the Money in the Bank, and Mark Henry was champion, and that sort of thing, and I honestly think that the plans were for me to be the first person to lose the Money in the Bank thing,
right.
And but then Mark got hurt. And he was in a feud with Big Show, and I had been kind of in this position for a while, where it's like I was the middleman for guys for their feuds.
Mm-hmm.
Like they did a Sin Cara feud, where it was like original Sin Cara beat me, then fake Sin Cara beat me, and then like I'm just the guy who sets up these guys as far
yeah.
as that. And I was that in the Big Show Mark Henry feud,
mm-hmm.
and then when Mark got hurt, it was more of a thing where it's like, well, what are our options here? And then all of a sudden, here I am as the World Heavyweight Champion. And I think, and it's those kind of lucky breaks where you get to go in and show what you can do as a performer that really helps turn the tide. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So like, you know, and a lot of that is just circumstance. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? Like, and it's strange because I feel like a lot of guys, like I certainly feel like I'm a very good performer, but I also feel like there have been a lot of very good performers who just haven't caught any breaks, who haven't been in that spot where they were. And the only reason I was really the Money in the Bank champion, I think, is because they didn't want two heels winning it that year. And Alberto was the other one, you know. And so it's like, you know, it's just a little series of things that that add up to a whole lot, you know?
Sure.
So.
Well, yeah, I mean, I knew too, like I often say this, I even wrote it in my new book that's coming out, that the moment that, you know, you came in through the door in the WWE, and I know you'd been there for a few times before and you'd flirted with the company, but when you came in with NXT, when they brought all the guys in, and we'll talk about that in a bit, I knew that you were going to make it the same way I knew that Punk was going to make it, the same way I knew Cesaro was going to make it, because when you've gotten over anywhere, it could be in the you know proverbial bingo hall or Ring of Honor or New Japan or wherever it is, it doesn't matter what level, when you've gotten to the top in any company, you kind of have an idea of what you have to do to get over. And it might take a little while to figure out in the different companies that you're in, but once you get over once, most of the time you have an idea and you can do it again. And I knew you were going to be able to do that. You would just have to figure out, how can I do that within this WWE system?
Yeah, and you also, it's a matter of figuring out what the fans want too,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and what the fans want is constantly evolving, and that happens with every company. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You can't, like right now, you couldn't go wrestle in New Japan like they wrestled in 1995 in New Japan, because it just wouldn't work. You know, the fan base is constantly evolving and that sort of thing, and the WWE base is constantly evolving. And I also feel bad for somebody like, gosh, I always forget what his name is on NXT, but El Generico. He's Sami Zayn.
Oh, Sami Zayn, right?
Yeah, and because he's awesome, but it's crazy because now on WWE television, you have all these guys doing pretty incredible stuff on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's harder to stand out, like, by doing good wrestling or that sort of thing, when you've got like so many guys right now, like you've got Cesaro, you've got Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose, like just the Shield in general, just the past year has put on so many like awesome matches that it's hard for somebody to come in, and even if you lose every match, he still had a good match, because there seems to be like great matches every week. So it's but that was actually one of the things too that helped, is that, you know, a guy like Cesaro and the guys in the Shield and stuff like that, like specifically Rollins and Ambrose, where they were able to go out there and do like, we've been given time, especially now that Raw is 3 hours, we can go out there and that we get time to actually wrestle now, which is really nice too. So
it makes a big difference, yeah, when you don't have to rush and you have a little bit of that option. And another thing you mentioned, which I think is a little bit ironic, is that NXT now, it's like if you are going to make it into the WWE, you got to go through the NXT system, which is cool. But most of the guys that are making it through the NXT system are guys that worked around for a while. You know, you're talking about Ring of Honor or working in Japan or whatever. And you said guys like The Shield and yourself and Cesaro and Sami Zayn and these guys. It makes me laugh, because I know that like the new verdict is like, you cannot make it in the WWE unless you come through NXT, and we're not hiring anybody else from independent companies. But meanwhile, all the guys that are over right now in the WWE and in NXT came from quote unquote independent companies.
Yeah, and it's just really interesting, you know. I don't know. Wrestling has evolved so much. Like, if you just think of, like, you know, and I obviously wasn't around, but you can even watch the footage of, like, Luthez, right? You know, like, and Luthez, you know, a lot of those guys did well because they were shooters and they were considered legit and all this kind of stuff. But they all had to... like, I don't know, not all of them, but most of them had to go work around in all these different places. And now it's so strange that if you pluck a football player, and I've believed this for a long time. So, for example, somebody like Titus O'Neil. I think Titus O'Neil has, like, a lot of upside. Like, he's very charismatic, has a personality and all that. But one of the things that's going to be hard for him going forward is that he's only learned one system and one way to do things. And, like, where even if you sign somebody to a developmental contract, I think it would behoove everybody to, like, send them to Europe for 6 months or send them to Japan for a couple months, you know, and just, like, have them go and learn different things. And then they can pick and choose what they want to do, you know.
Yeah, I agree with it. Because also, too, another thing I know from my experiences, I'm sure you would agree as well, is you can, like you said, pick and choose, but you take little things from different places. Like, okay, I remember this worked in Japan, and this worked in Mexico, and this worked in ECW or Ring of Honor. And it creates your style where, you know, you're not a copy of anybody else. You're your own guy, because you were able to kind of take all these little ingredients and throw them into the blender and shake it up, and then suddenly you have your style.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's hard for a lot of those guys, you know, who just kind of end up learning one thing. You know, one of the things that I attribute to my success is that, like, I've been thrown into a lot of weird situations and stuff before I got to WWE, so I wasn't really fazed by a lot of it, you know, like, okay. Like, the hardest part is, like, wait a second, how do you even do a 3-minute match? You know what
I know.
I mean? Like, I've never had to do that before. Like, okay, but, like, I can try different things. And, like, and then, too, like, just being on shows with, like, a guy like Yuji Nagata or something like that, who knew how to work like he was, knew how to wrestle like he was over, you know?
Yeah.
And seeing, like, the guys who are big stars and how they handled themselves and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I just feel bad for guys who, if they've only come in and known one thing, because that's got to make it really hard.
Yeah, and also, too, well, first of all, two things that you mentioned. One, I mean, that is the art form of all art forms, having a match in 3 minutes. And that was something, to this day, I could never walk out of the ring after having a 3-minute match and go, man, that was great. Like, even if it was the best three, you know what I mean? Like, it's always, like, feels like such a rush. And, like, you know, I just always feel like you left something, it could have been so much better. But that's the hardest thing, I think, about doing TV matches is the short matches.
Yeah, and not only that, like, you get all worked, like, as, you know, as guys who enjoy wrestling, right? And I like to get worked up about wrestling. Like, all right, I'm excited. Most of the time, I'm excited to go out there and wrestle. And it's just like, oh, it's like a letdown for myself.
Yeah.
It's like you go out there and you're like, yeah. And the worst to me is when, like, a crowd is really good.
Yes.
And then you're out there for only 3 minutes and you know, like,
they wanted more and you wanted more. And then, like, there's only been a couple times I've come back to the curtain hot, and it's never been because somebody messed up or because something wasn't good or something like that. It's been because, like, one time was different, but most of the time it's been like, oh my gosh, that could have been so much more. Why was this only 3 minutes? Like, this could have been like an awesome experience, and now it was just bleh.
What? Yeah. So. Or you just get a taste. Dude, that happened to us. I remember the first match you ever had on NXT was against me, and I was the world champion at the time. And at first, I remember, like, because this is when they made us do NXT, and I was like in a bad mood anyways, because I was working like 5 days a week or 6 days a week, and I was like, I don't even want to wrestle tonight. I don't want to do this. And I remember thinking about it, and like, you know, this is going to be really good. Like, you know, Daniel Bryan versus Jericho. We've never done this before. And then I was like, what am I complaining about? Like, this is awesome. And then after all that, I see the script and I see that we have 6 minutes.
Right.
And that made me so mad. I was like, this is the first NXT. You guys want to put on a new show and you got all these great new performers. And you got a match that some people will think this is a dream match. You know, two guys, actually both of us saying that we're the best in the world, all this other stuff. And then they gave us 6 minutes. And I was just so disappointed in that because I knew, you know, we could have gone 60 minutes had they given us the opportunity.
Yeah. And I'm like, and it's funny because, like, I go with things pretty well. I don't get real upset about a lot of stuff, but, like, it's just frustrating when you see something like that. And like, I don't know, like, and that's, I think, but I it's good. It's good that I get upset over that kind of stuff because that means that I still love to wrestle. You know what I mean? And like, I almost dread the day where I look and I see, like, 4 minutes, and I'm like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you ever feel that way, it's time to go home.
Literally.
But yeah, but I remember too, because in that match, remember you did the suicide dive and you shot right over me and we crashed into the announce table. And it was one of the coolest bumps ever. And I remember because I still to this day, it's one of my biggest, it still pisses me off that I didn't go with it, you know, but because we were in a time constraint, I just threw you back in the ring and we just kept going. This still bugs me, you know, and like you said, maybe that's a good thing, but I still like, damn it. I would have just recalled the whole thing and just would have said, screw the time. They can edit it if they want to, you know?
Yeah. And that's the, you know, and that's the thing. And that's, it's really fun to me to talk to people who love wrestling because you obsess over those little things, right?
Right.
Like, you know, some people who don't love wrestling and who just do this because, okay, it's a good paycheck or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they don't obsess over the little details and stuff like that. But I feel like a lot of guys like myself and you and that sort of thing, if we didn't obsess over those little details, we wouldn't have gotten to
that's
where
right.
we did, you know, like we had to do that to get to that sort of thing. But it's always just fun too to just talk with people who love wrestling about wrestling. Because,
I know.
It's always interesting. So
you know, it's almost like two nerds talking about, you know, Star Wars or computers. Like
or
when you
comic
put
comic books.
Yeah. When you put wrestlers together, chances are within about 10 seconds you're going to end up talking about wrestling. That's just the way it goes.
Do you know what's funny? So, like, wrestling to me has this whole, like, nerd culture amongst wrestlers, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, like, you can talk, guys who are really big, like, Cesaro, like, you know, he still, like, watches all this wrestling, you know what I mean? And I watch a decent amount of wrestling, and he's like, oh my gosh, did you see this Japanese something or another? And I'd be like, yeah. And it's like, if we were two high school kids, you'd be like, man, look at these two nerds talking about some sort of Japanese wrestling that they looked up on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And so, but then it's funny because I find that about anything that people are passionate about, because, you know, CrossFit is huge now, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you talk to CrossFit people about CrossFit, they're legit like CrossFit nerds. And like they have like, you know, they have these people that like Seth Rollins is what I consider a CrossFit nerd. Like he is like he follows like CrossFitters, like these big name CrossFitters who I've never heard of.
Big name CrossFitters, what?
Just machine rode 6,000 meters in a certain time, and I'm like, and they watch it. Like, how do you watch somebody on a rowing machine for 30 minutes? Like,
it's like watching NASCAR.
Oh no, you didn't understand his split time and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh man, like you're such a nerd. And then I realized, like, wait a second.
Yeah, guilty.
So.
I love you said the famous CrossFitters. Like, what?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Talk is Jericho.
Okay, we're back with Daniel Bryan. So were you obviously a wrestling fan when you were growing up?
Yeah, oh yeah, I was a huge wrestling fan. And so it's actually interesting. My my father passed away.
I know. Sorry, man.
Yeah, not Monday, but the Monday before. And so I went back to Aberdeen for his funeral and all that kind of stuff. But my uncle, my dad was one of six children. So my uncle Lucky, who is the closest to my dad in that, he ended up marrying the mother of my best friend when I was in first grade.
Okay.
My best friend when I was in first grade, his name is Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren introduced me to this guy named Abe Godfrey. And Abe Godfrey, it was Abe Godfrey's first day at school, and we all came back to my house, and Abe was like, okay, I've got something in my backpack, but you have to promise not to tell anybody if I show you. And we're like, oh, okay, you know, because we're in first grade and we don't know any better, right? It's like, oh. And he pulls out these wrestling magazines, and we start looking through them. And I don't come from a family who liked wrestling. My dad never watched it. My mom never watched it. Nobody ever watched it. And just this kid, Abe Godfrey, pulled out these magazines, and I was just instantly hooked. And and just being somebody who was, I've always enjoyed reading and all that kind of stuff, and then the pictures and everything. It's just, wrestling is just magic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially when you get sucked into it from a young age. So.
Well, and it was different back then, too, because now, I mean, you can go online and you can read behind the scenes and you can subscribe to the Wrestling Observer, you know, behind the scenes dirt sheet. But back then, you couldn't. Like, all you knew is what they would show you on TV. And you could read an Apter magazine, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, but it was all, you know, all made up anyways. So I never knew that wrestling wasn't quote-unquote real until I was about 19 or 20 years old, as stupid as that sounds now. But there was no way to find out.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's amazing because you just watch it. And, there were guys that I thought were not real. Like, okay, and I don't know why this person sticks out specifically to me, but I remember always watching Dino Bravo and being like, oh, this guy's not really tough. Like, he wouldn't win any real fights. And
wow.
I don't know where I got the idea that Dino Bravo was not tough, but the Ultimate Warrior was.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I got these ideas from, but for some reason I thought that what Dino Bravo did was phony, and then
which is weird, right?
Was 100% legit. You know, I would love to be able to go back into my own head and see how I thought about things, but yeah, it's
you know, I was the same. I remember I used to watch Stampede Wrestling, and the tag team was Bruce Hart and Brian Pillman. And to me, I thought Brian Pillman is amazing, but this Bruce Hart is terrible. And I didn't really know why he was terrible. I just knew he was. And then you look back and it's because, well, he's terrible, you know?
He's terrible.
But even as a fan, I could figure that out, you know, but not really knowing the reasons why. So, I mean, so you grew up a wrestling fan. You wanted to, so then you decided that you wanted to be a wrestler when you were still living in Aberdeen?
Yeah, and so I had kind of decided it was, in 1996 is when WCW started bringing in all the cruiserweights and all that kind of stuff. And actually, '95 that Eddie and Dean and those guys come
and Benoit,
in.
Yeah.
But then in 96 is when Ray came in,
mm-hmm.
and I was really thinking about, oh man, I'd really like to be a wrestler in 1995. Keep in mind, I'm 14 years old at that point. And so I'm okay. But then in 96, when Ray came in, and Ray was only 5'3", and in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated, it said 135 pounds or whatever it was, you watched him, and all these excuses that I had as to why I might not be able to be a pro wrestler, they all went out the window,
Yeah.
And then, I found out later that year, because I was a sophomore, that Dean Malenko, who was my favorite wrestler, Dean was my favorite, my absolute favorite, and that he had a wrestling school. I was like, because I didn't realize wrestling schools existed. I didn't know what that was. But somehow I found out, and I don't even remember how. Oh, I think in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, they had an advertisement,
do you want to be a pro wrestler? Hey, $20 or something like that, and we'll send you a book that tells you how to be a pro wrestler. And I was like, oh, okay. And essentially all it did was just like, you have to get gear. Here's places where to get gear. You have to get training. Here's places where you can get training. But like you said, there wasn't, like, the internet wasn't.
Right.
Wasn't,
you couldn't just so look up and find it.
So, like, that's what you had to do to find out. And so, and I saw in there that there was the Malenko School of Wrestling. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's the holy grail of, like, the biggest find, you know.
Yeah.
You know, for a kid that's 15 years old. And so I was 15. I was, like, working at McDonald's, and I sent my $500 deposit to, I forget what the lady's name was, but just to reserve my spot. Because here I was thinking that there would be this several-year-long wait to get into the Malenko School of Wrestling. So I needed to reserve my spot now.
Right.
And, of course, my senior year of high school, which was 1999, I 3 months before I was graduating, Phyllis Lee was her name. Phyllis Lee gave me a call and said, oh, I'm sorry, the Malenko School of Wrestling is closing.
Oh.
Like, you know, and I was like, oh, like, what am I going to do? Because I haven't applied for any colleges. I haven't done anything like that, you know? Like,
yeah.
What am I going to do with my life? And, you know, and then, of course, I was working, like, I worked a bunch of minimum wage jobs, right? So $500 is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know if it was my friend Evan or who told me, but that Shawn Michaels was opening up a school. And it was... It was substantially more expensive. but then I ended up going to Sean's. And so that ended all up working out for the best, I guess.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's something similar happened to me when I first applied to go to the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp and Stampede Wrestling. And then when I did get to go, but 6 months before I went to camp, Stampede Wrestling closed. And it was the same feeling, like, ah. Oh. So close, man. What do I do? But you just have right. to, you know, I mean, and that's the thing about Dean Malenko, man. I mean, he was so fluid of a wrestler. And people forget, if you've never seen Dean or if you just know him now as kind of the behind-the-scenes producer, I mean, that guy was as smooth as silk in the ring. And I think he's pretty underrated when you look at the history of great performers, because not a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, Dean Malenko's one of the best. But I think he still, to this day, is one of the best.
Well, and to me, as far, I mean, there's different... you know, when I look at wrestling, I feel like I'm a wrestling student still mm-hmm. to this day, what works and what doesn't work and all that kind of stuff. As far as his technique goes, I don't think that there's anybody better at mat wrestling than Dean. Like, he was so good at all of that. And not only that, so creative with everything that he did and all that kind of stuff. And it was funny because it was... probably 2011 or something like that, I had asked Dean to show me this one thing that I'd seen him do, and he still did it. I don't know how old Dean is right now. I think he's 50 or
he's 50.
Or
he's 54.
There.
I think he's 54.
Yeah, and he did it so quick and so much better than me. And I tried to do it like 5 or 6 times, and then eventually just gave up out of embarrassment more than anything else. Like, it was just like. But, you know, he trained with Carl Gotch and, like, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever wrestle his brother? Did you ever meet his brother?
No, we did a couple angles with him in WCW, but he had retired by that point. But I watched, I mean, obviously, classic Malenko Brothers versus British Bulldogs from All Japan. I mean, there's some tremendous matches with the two of them.
Yeah, and, like, so, like, I would always seek out, like, the, you know, obscure kind of matches. And now nothing's obscure because you have YouTube, you know, and so, like, guys can, but like Joe wrestling a guy named Masafuchi, and they were doing like all this crazy mat wrestling that you'd never seen in the United States, and like, and then Dean did all that stuff, but then just did it way more fluid, and then mixed it with these fast paced matches, where those matches I don't think would have ever gotten over in the United States at the time. You know what I mean? They were just kind of too slow. But Dean incorporated all that stuff into like a fast paced style. And it was just, he was just incredible.
Well, and that's the thing, like you just mentioned, you try and do some of the stuff that they make it look so easy. And then, you know, I would try it and it would just look awful. And there was some of those guys, I'm sure you know Johnny Saint from England.
Yeah.
That guy, probably the most obscure name that's ever been mentioned on Talk is Jericho, but it's this English guy called Johnny Saint, and he does stuff that I've never seen anybody else do, and it's so fluid and cool looking, but if you try it, it looks just terrible. It looks like a joke, you know?
Oh yeah, and there was a big movement in independent wrestling several years ago as far as the European style.
Mm-hmm.
So I got first introduced to European wrestling by Regal in
right.
In 2000 when I went and trained with him, and so he was telling me, but it was just literally like he would kind of show me stuff, but there was no way to get access to that.
Yeah.
Right? Well, then again, you know, through YouTube and through DVD trainers and whatever it is, you know, like all of a sudden that stuff kind of became readily available, and a lot of independent wrestlers are huge wrestling nerds, right? So
mm-hmm.
they're, you know, ordering all this stuff and watching it, and you have no idea how many terrible Johnny Saint impersonations I have seen throughout my career. It's like, you know, like there was a certain logic to their like wrist lock reversals and all that kind of stuff, but
yeah.
The guys were just trying to do the things, not nearly as smooth and without any of the logic that came with the world of sport. And so, yeah,
it looks so bad, right?
It's pretty funny.
I remember when Negro Casas is the La Magistral, he would do like this little roll up pin thing, and it in about the mid 90s, late 90s, everyone was trying to do the Magistral, and you know, you can't, for whatever reason, that's Negro Casas' thing, and there'd be, like you said, dozens of really bad Magistrals going on in matches everywhere of guys thinking like.
You know what's funny is I specifically remember a very bad Billy Kidman on Magistral cradle. Like, like I remember watching it because it was still like I had started wrestling at this point, and I had watched it. And I was like, oh my gosh, that might be the worst cradle I've ever seen. And you know, and I forgot about it entirely until right now, and I'm gonna have to bring it up to him.
That's right, because we all thought like, oh wow, we can do this, but it's not the case. Now you were lucky that you got to train with Regal. I mean, I know you had a lot of flirtations with the WWE before you finally came in for NXT. Which I believe was in 2010, but you worked, you were signed by the WWE and then you got fired and then you might have come back and you got fired again. I mean, there's so much history of all the stuff that you've done throughout the years, but I want to focus when you were brought back to the WWE for NXT. Tell us, how did you come back? Because I think 2002 is when you first came and got let go, and then 2010, suddenly you return. What were the circumstances to bring you back again?
Well, it's interesting because in 2009, January of 2009, I thought, okay, the injuries were kind of mounting up a little bit. And independent wrestling, although I was getting paid well for an independent wrestler, it wasn't enough to where it's like, okay, I'm going to be able to save up for any sort of retirement or anything like that. And so in 2009, I decided, okay, I really want to make a run at trying to get into the WWE, just as kind of a thing.
Like a last chance sort of thing.
Yeah, but to do that, I'm going to need to change my style a little bit, because what I do here on the independents and in Japan is not going to work there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved to Las Vegas and started training at Extreme Couture, kickboxing and grappling and stuff nearly every day that I wasn't wrestling, and just so I would get better at the kicks and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then and my contract that year with Ring of Honor had ended, and I want to say May of 2009. And so after that, I was actually, you know, I had talked to Regal, I had talked to Brian Kendrick. And Brian was doing a thing where he was the Brian Kendrick, and at the time he was looking for the tag team partner. And he had called me and was like, I would love for you to come to this spot. You know, everybody knows that you can wrestle, but they want to see if you can talk. If you can fly yourself out to Oakland, I want to say it was, and we can just do some interview type stuff, that would be really great. So I flew out there, I did the interview type stuff, and it went really well. And I didn't meet with anybody important. You know, I talked to Brawler and stuff, you know, but like, and then met with Johnny Ace a little bit. But then Brian got let go. And it was literally like, oh, crap. Well, there goes kind of my chances, you know. And so, I was trying and talking to Regal about it and that sort of thing. But at this point, I had pretty much decided at the end of the year
I'm going to go back to Washington, and I'm going to start going back to school, and I'll wrestle on the weekends because I still get paid well for it, but I have to switch my focus to some sort of career that will sustain me for when I'm done wrestling.
Right.
And then literally probably like 3 weeks after Brian got let go, John called me and asked me if I wanted a deal. And I said, yeah. And then there were complications because I had like elevated liver enzymes. And like when they go through that medical screening, all this stuff. And like I had really super high liver enzymes. And the guy said, well, are you a drinker? And I said, no, I've never drank in my life. And he's like, do you use steroids? Nope, never done steroids in my life. And they said, well, typically with elevated liver enzymes, with as high as yours are, the main reasons are alcohol abuse, steroid abuse, or cancer. Can you imagine telling that to somebody on the phone? And like, here I am thinking, dude, I have cancer, and like, they did all these tests, and I didn't have cancer, and I don't think they ever figured out why my liver enzymes were so high, and that my liver enzymes are still high to this day. But the three major things that they needed to check about, I cleared that, and so.
Let me just interject quickly. Let me tell you something, just so you know, because the same thing happened to me where I had elevated testosterone. Okay, it was like at a 10-1 or something instead of a 4-1. And they said, okay, are you on steroids? No. Whatever. Are you on this? Are you on that? No. And then the guy goes, and this is the same thing. He goes, well, if you're not on steroids, then you probably have a tumor, which is why your levels are higher. The same thing. I'm like, what? Who says that to anybody on the phone? I was so mad at him. And then I had to go to an endocrinologist and find out that I just had a naturally elevated level of testosterone. But it seems like a little theme here. These guys are just throwing out the cancer word like nothing. So anyways, you're not alone, man. So.
Yeah. And you know what? It's funny. I mean, it's not funny but Nigel McGuinness got signed at the same time.
Yeah.
And you know, when they're going through the thing, have you ever had any shoulder problems or anything like that, you know, any surgeries of this or that. And I wasn't exactly honest, you know.
Right.
I'm just trying to get through this thing. Well, Nigel is honest to a fault and says, like, oh, yeah, I tore my bicep, like, last year. And then they said, well, did you get it surgically repaired? No, I let it heal naturally. But, you know, my doctor says that it's 100% repaired and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And, but then they sent him to a couple different doctors and all that kind of stuff, and he ended up not passing the physical. And it's like, here's a guy who had probably more upside than I had as far as like what WWE wants, as far as what they're looking for, and he didn't even get the opportunity because of to me, and like that's when I say things like you need a lot of luck to kind of get to where like Nigel just didn't get that luck, right?
Yeah.
Because he's an awesome speaker, he's an awesome wrestler. He was he had a great look. He's over 6 feet tall. Like he's, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he just didn't even get the opportunity, but then, then I sat at home for like 4 months not knowing what to do with myself while I waited to see if they were going to do anything with me. And then they told me that, we were going to start doing this NXT thing. So
now you were Bryan Danielson, which is your name. And then you came in NXT as Daniel Bryan. Why did they want you to change your name?
You know, it's pretty much, I think, just so that they can own the rights to it is what I think. But they asked me for like a list of 10 names, right? Regal is actually the one who came up with Daniel Bryan.
Uh-huh.
And, but like I had some pretty outlandish names because really I just wanted to be Bryan Danielson.
Yeah.
And I remember having a conversation with you actually sometime around the time I came in and, you know, it like, because, you know, my hardcore fans who had been following me for years, and I mean, they're not that many. You know what I mean? There's like 5,000 maybe.
Independent basis, you had a big name, though.
Yeah. But they were very upset by this whole change. But like, it's a lot better than some of the names I suggested. One of the ones I really liked was Buddy Peacock. Because like, I just imagine people, like, it's just a funny name. People can either chant Buddy or they can chant Peacock. And it's just, you know, probably a pretty bad suggestion had they actually gone with it.
Regal told me that story, and I mentioned my book earlier, and I talk about NXT, and actually one of the chapter titles is Buddy Peacock.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. So you could have been Buddy Peacock, but you went with Daniel Bryan, which is better.
Yeah, the other one I suggested was Lloyd Bonnier, and Bonnier is spelled B-O-N with a tilde over the N-E-R. So.
That's so awesome, man. I love it. We're going to have to stop here today, though, and pick up again on Friday with WWE World Champion Daniel Bryan. So much more to talk about, but right now we are going to play the song that's sweeping the nation, the platter that matters, the hit that will make you shine forever. We're going to do Lights Go Out right here, right now on Talk Is Jericho. Crank it up, baby! Checking out Talk Is Jericho today. Thanks to Daniel Bryan. Thanks to Rich Ward for writing that amazing song, Lights Go Out by Fozzy. If you like it, go check it out on iTunes. And you can actually go to Amazon and buy it. And if you do so, use my Amazon link, not only when you buy Lights Go Out, but every time you do your online shopping. It's really easy to find. Just go to podcast1.com, click on the Keep Our Podcasts Free banner at the top of the page, and then click on Talk Is Jericho, and you'll see all three of my Amazon links in the UK, in Canada, and in the US of A. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show, so we can keep doing this for you for free twice a week. There's no hidden extra fees, no hidden charges. You're just getting your shopping done and helping me out in the process. Once again, on Friday, part two of my amazing conversation with WWE World Champion Daniel Bryan. We're going to get into his first go-round at the WWE, how he got fired by Vince McMahon and then ultimately brought back. Plus, we'll talk WrestleMania 28 and 30 and the origin of the Yes Chant. So much more great stuff coming up on Friday with DB, the world champion of the WWE. So we'll see you then. Stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.